Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 25th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And this week, we have an exciting chat for you today, as we do every week. Come on. I aim not to disappoint. But before we dive in, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible. As you've heard me say before, now about 380 times, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that is because I rely on the support of listeners just like you. If you would like to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy to learn more. You can also check out the Talk Nerdy page at carasantamaria.com/podcast, or even easier, talknerdy.com. This week's top supporters include Rob Schreck, Daniel Lang, Mary Neva, Krister Jansen, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J. E. Smith, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so very much from the bottom of my heart. All right, let's talk about this week's show. So I had the opportunity to sit down with the author of The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. His name is John Dunn, and he's a natural history writer, photographer, and wildlife tour leader. He's written, you know, across a bunch of outlets like BBC Wildlife. He's also written three previous books, one called Orchid Summer, and he currently lives on a croft, which, if you don't know about crofters, they're so cool. I would definitely recommend looking it up, in the remote Shetland Islands, and we'll talk about that on the show. So without any further ado, here he is, the author of The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds, John Dunn. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Cara.
So, of course, it is a morning for me here in Los Angeles. It is, as you mentioned when we first connected, happy hour in all the way out in Shetland. We've been talking about Scotland and talking about Shetland off air before we start the recording. But you are very far away from not just me, but from your own mainland.
Yeah, I'm at some remove from civilization. Shetland's closer to the Arctic Circle than it is to London. And my nearest train station is Bergen in Norway. So yeah, I'm in Britain, but kind of only just.
Right. And so how long have you been living in Shetland? Because I do not detect a Scottish accent.
No, I'm a Cornishman originally. I moved to Shetland about 20 years ago. And I've been here, based here ever since, and using it as a base to explore the world and show people really cool wildlife. That's what I love doing.
Right. So, you know, in your, I guess we could say your career, you are a naturalist, you are a wildlife writer, an explorer. But of course, your career is not separate from your personal life. It's not separate from your, you know, fundamental interests. So really, is that why you chose to live in Shetland?
This is exactly it. A little potted history. From a very young age, I knew I wanted nothing more than to be in nature, learning about the natural world. My mum and dad had other plans. They thought I should be a lawyer. And so I am a thwarted scientist. I'm not a scientist. I'm a layman. I'm totally self-taught. Having said that, I wanted to live in the wildest place I could in Britain. And so when I graduated from university, I wasted very little time in moving up here. It's an incredible place to see bird migration. We're close to the continental shelf edge, so you see lots of exciting cetaceans here. I see humpback whales from the kitchen window. I know, it's an absolutely marvelous place. You see all sorts of incredible vagrant birds from Siberia every autumn, but also from North America, from you know, your neck of the woods. So it's a really exciting place to live. And people from all over the world come here to see the bird migration. And I live in the heart of it. And that's really exciting.
And of course, I can't help but imagine being so close to the Arctic Circle, being so far north, that the light show must be just stunning.
Yeah, it is. The Aurora Borealis, being that close to the Arctic Circle, we get a lot of aurora activity above us. We don't always get to see it because we have a hyperoceanic climate. We are so, you know, out there in the Atlantic and sort of on the cusp of the Atlantic Ocean, the North Sea, and a little touch of Arctic Ocean coming down from the north. So there is a lot of weather here. And that means a lot of wind. You might hear a little wind noise in the background because it's blowing a hooli outside the window at the moment. But a lot of rain as well, a lot of cloud cover. So frustratingly, sometimes you look at the aurora predictions and you know there's a complete pyrotechnic light show going on overhead and you can't see a thing. But sometimes it is off the scale brilliant. You pull open the curtains in the evening and you look out and there are these huge curtains and blossoms of light happening in the sky, and you can see them with the naked eye. A lot of the photos, of course, you see are taken with cameras with, you know, slightly longer exposure, but to be able to actually see stuff happening with the naked eye is pretty special, and you feel sort of touched by the universe when that happens.
Absolutely. It's something I've yet to see in all of my travels. And although I've been to Scotland several times, I've not gone to Scandinavia. I've not gone any farther north. I've been up in, you know, I have been up in Russia. I've been up in Kazakhstan, but I've never been quite in the regions or Iceland or any of these areas where I know the aurora are so stunning. I have to get there. I have to.
You do, and much as I would love you to come and visit in Shetland, there are more reliable places to see the aurora than here. So get yourself to Iceland or Svalbard, and you'll see some magnificent stuff. It really is very special, and it's something I highly recommend everyone sees once in their life.
Absolutely. I'll come say hi along the way.
Yeah, come drop in. So come at happy hour.
Exactly, right now. So yeah. You mentioned, you know, when you were describing sort of your upbringing and you know, the pressures from your parents and, you know, the twists and turns in your education, that you really sort of followed the path of sort of the tradition of the historical naturalist. Like many, you know, even Charles Darwin was not a, quote, trained scientist. He was a naturalist in the truest sense. He was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I want to get on a boat and then I will figure it out as I go. And ultimately, yeah, that was his career. But at the beginning, he wasn't trained for that.
No, well, this is it. I was born, I think, 200 years out of time. I should have been born. I should have been born in sort of the late 1700s or early 1800s, because, yeah, you mentioned Darwin, and there was the great English naturalist Gilbert White, who wrote The Natural History of Selborne. And these were guys who had inquisitive, questing minds and didn't have any knowledge of what they were seeing necessarily. They just had a little acquired knowledge up to the point they were starting. And for me, starting out in the 1970s and 1980s, which betrays my age, as a young boy, I kind of was starting in the same place, because there was no internet, of course. And my mum and dad had a couple of really basic natural history books in the house. And we are talking seriously basic stuff. And so I was going out and I was seeing everything from scratch, anew, and having to work it out for myself. And that stands you, I think, in really good stead as a naturalist, as a broad spectrum naturalist in later life, because you get the tool set to look at things without any sort of prejudice or prior expectation. Of course, you know, I did something which I guess as a writer stood me in good stead. My mum was ever so good. She would take me to the library, and, you know, I'd go to the school library as well, and you know, research stuff, which sounds really old school. Without using Google, I'd be sat there looking through books, right, and actually, you know,
using the card catalog.
Yeah, totally. And cross-referencing, because, you know, you'd look at one book which was written in the 1950s, and then you'd look at something from the 1850s, and you know, you'd realize there were discrepancies, and actually some of these old books had insight and wisdom which had been lost by the oversimplification of the later books. And so even now, as a natural history writer, now I have a horrendous library of thousands of books here in the house. I'm like a magpie, because there's stuff there which just isn't on the internet and isn't in later books. And it's absolutely bang on in terms of accuracy. And it's, you know, it's lovely to have that resource. And so I guess, yeah, you're right. I am a traditional old school naturalist. And I love having that questing mind. I mean, lockdown, the whole COVID, awful. last 18 months, 2 years. And I feel awkward saying this, but it was kind of a blessing in a way, because, you know, you're forced to look really locally at what's around you. You couldn't travel. You couldn't travel even more than a couple of miles from home. And it forced me to, in the times when the breeding birds weren't back here in Shetland and the weather was ghastly, I thought, well, you know, I need to look at stuff. I'm bored. I finished writing this book. And so I started looking at lichen. And, you know, suddenly I realized that for the past 18, 19 years, I'd been here in Shetland wasting my time. I hadn't realized there was this whole incredible world of stuff right under my nose. And I love this because there are every sort of different branch of the natural history tree. There is stuff to see if you just open your eyes. And since the start of this year, since January the 1st, I've added 13 new species of lichen to the known lichen list of the island I live on. And there's one or two kind of interesting ones in the context of the whole of Shetland, but a lot of them are just things which nobody's noticed. They're very common, but no one's been here looking. And this is the case all around the world. You know, wherever you are, your listeners in the US and everywhere else, with lichen at least, you can go out there, and if you've got a camera, digital camera, a phone, better yet, a hand lens to look closely at this stuff, you will find new things which haven't been recorded in your neighborhood, your state. It's just unbelievable. I'm sorry, I know we're here to talk about something completely different, but
I love it though. I mean, it speaks to this kind of, not just the enthusiasm, but the, I don't know, it's funny because it's something that I feel it's obviously not been lost. It's something that you're still actively experiencing, enjoying. But for many of us who live in cities, or for those of us who have very just like fast-paced kind of lifestyles, I think this idea, and this translates to almost every field. I work in mental health, and clearly this translates to, you know, psychology, but really to almost every field, this idea of stopping, looking, smelling, tasting, just being, and, you know, quote, in nature, whatever that actually means, but just being in the moment, I think, is something that we've kind of forgotten how to do.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that was something which the pandemic, for many people, and I've been, you know, talking to a lot of folk, to botanists, to birders, to lichen people, to all sorts in the past 18 months. A lot of people, as I said a moment ago, were forced to slow down and work from home, and their leisure time was spent within walking distance of home for a great many months. And, you know, all of this came at some terrible costs to, you know, some of the really important stuff, which, you know, makes us human, the social interactions that we have face to face. But it also gave people an opportunity to do just what you said of slowing down and disconnecting a bit and getting closer, you know, looking closer to home and being a little more mindful. We were forced to do something which we've kind of forgotten how to do in this wonderful high-tech interconnected world. And I think that's been a bit of the sugar coating on the pandemic pill. It's been a blessing, a hidden blessing. And it's something I certainly intend to take away from it now that the world is, you know, touch wood, hopefully becoming a little more open and we're starting to perhaps see a little light at the end of the tunnel. I want to hang on to that sort of joy that I've rediscovered in the local and the mindfulness of just being, and as you say, in nature, whatever that means. That doesn't necessarily mean traveling to Shetland or to Ecuador or wherever. It can actually just mean walking out into your street and looking at what's growing and the cracks in the pavement, because that's special too. And this was the other really interesting thing. The lichen, as a photographer, of course, it's a macro photography thing. You know, you're looking at the very, very small and trying to take a decent picture of that. And that's, I think, important. There is a world in microcosm in your own backyard, or as I say, in the cracks in the pavement. Some of my happiest botanizing memories come from being in the States and walking around Central Park and finding broadleaved helleborines, which it's an awful thing. You guys call it weed helleborine for good reason, because it's a really ghastly invasive. But it's you know, it's really interesting to find those things growing in an urban context, and to understand the sort of story of how they came to be there and actually their impact on your native orchid species. You know, all of this stuff is really interesting. And every organism, whether it's a lichen or lichen are amazing, but whether it's lichen or beetles or birds or plants, they all have a story attached. And this comes back to that sort of researching thing. I love the fact that you go beyond just the name of something. When, you know, some of those we'll see with the hummingbird, some of the names are just crazy. They're fantastic. But go beyond the name and dig down a little deeper. Who found that thing? Who identified that thing in the first place? What was their story? What does that organism have as a life, you know, life cycle, a lifestyle? There's so much cool stuff. How is it adapting to our, you know, anthropomorphically changing world? You know, I people sort of say to me about you know, oh, it must have been hard in the lockdown. You know, you know your income gets constrained as a naturalist. Actually, you know, income isn't the important thing here. What I feel short of is time. I don't have enough time to see and to learn and to explore as much as I want to. And you know, I've been doing this since I was a little boy, and one lifetime is not long enough. I'm digressing massively.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it sounds like that sort of passion, that hunger, really not just doesn't know no bounds, but it doesn't discriminate. Because like you said, we've been talking about lichen. You've written several books, one of which was about orchids, as you referenced. And of course, your new book is called The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds, which you gave a nod to. And sort of speaking back to what you were saying about, even if you live in a very industrial area, very urban area, looking at, you know, what is growing through the cracks in the sidewalk, I can attest to the fact I live in Los Angeles, on the east side of Los Angeles, in a neighborhood called Eagle Rock. I live in a small lot home, meaning that it's like a three-story house that's quite small. Like, the amount of land I own is less than the square footage of my house, because it's built very close to several other houses, and they're built tall instead of wide, you know, as a way to kind of, I guess, be very efficient in our usage. But I spend quite a bit of time on my roof. I have a deck. My roof is converted into a deck. And I have hummingbirds that visit me regularly.
That's so wonderful. And, you know, some species, as you know, we may come to discuss, are incredibly sensitive and vulnerable, but some are astonishingly adaptable. And I mean, all hummingbirds are tough, but almost by definition from their sort of biology, they have to be. And I love the fact that, you know, you get hummingbirds on, you know, up on the deck, three stories up. Mm-hmm. And
four, actually. Yeah, it's the fourth
four stories.
Floor.
That's just crazy.
I know, it's amazing.
I thought so too. I have massive jealousy.
Yeah, I put out a hummingbird feeder when I first moved into this house, and I thought, who knows, we'll see. And within days, they were coming to visit and to drink.
And once you've started as a pusher, pushing sugar water, that's it. You have to keep feeding that habit. Otherwise, you know, you've got some really pissed off hummingbirds. So.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. So let's talk hummingbirds now. I mean, clearly you are an individual who has dedicated your life to stopping, to looking, to experiencing. And so there's something about different species, different ecological, as I say, coming from the south of the U.S., niches. Niches.
Yeah, you have a niche. Like. You say niche and I say niche. It's potato,
yes, exactly.
Potato.
But clearly there are different things that appeal to you based on your own life experience, based on your own exposure. What is it about hummingbirds that captured you so that you decided to dedicate an entire book to it?
I am, as a naturalist and as a nature writer, I am a bit like a bowerbird. I am really attracted to color and form, especially color. And so we spoke a moment ago, and you mentioned I'd written a book all about orchids. You know, there's tons of brilliant wildflowers that grow native in Britain and Europe, but the orchids are just especially remarkable in terms of color and form. You know, this is a rainbow of colors and some incredible, especially in Europe, some incredible species that mimic insects to in their flowers to get insects to try and pseudo-copulate to mate with the flower and hence to pollinate them. So there's some fantastic stuff, and I found that really compelling. And the same sort of principle applies to hummingbirds. I mean, aren't birds wonderful? They're fantastic. You know, we've got living dinosaurs in our midst, and they see in color. I mean, I love mammals, but, you know, a lot of mammals are seeing in shades of gray. Birds, full technicolor, gloriously so. And, you know, the plumages are reflecting that, of course, because they're seeing a colorful world. But, you know, why hummingbirds out of all the birds? Well, there's a nature writer who described hummingbirds to me, a guy called Tim Dee, and he described them as birds 2.0. And I love that because they are kind of birds, but more, you know, they're birds, but upgraded. And so any sort of bird which you know, has wings that beat at you know, 1,000 beats per minute, a heart that beats 1,000 beats per minute, and wings which are beating 50 times per second. So that's just some colossal statistics. I love this stuff. I'm such a nerd. most, and I mean that as in a good way.
Oh, yeah, so same. You're on the nerdy right now with me.
Yeah, that is not a pejorative word.
Not at all. I wouldn't have named my podcast for it.
No, exactly. This is a badge of honor completely. Most birds, pectoral muscles, their breast muscles, the ones which do the flap, if you will, take up about 15% of their body weight. Hummingbirds, it's twice that, it's a third. You know, they're just superlative pinnacles of evolution. But, you know, to take it back to, you know, why, how did I get hooked on them? We have to go back to my poor mum, the one who wasn't particularly encouraging about my natural history interests. But now I'm being unkind to my poor mum, because actually she knew that I didn't want to be a lawyer. And every now and again, there would be a little nod to what was really firing me up. And one day she took me to London, and we lived in the West Country of England, down in the southwest. So a very rural environment. And she took me up to London. I think it might have been the first time I'd been to the capital. And I mean, oh God, you know, anyone who's been to London, there are those touristy things you have to do. And it's no different if you're living here in the UK, if you've never been before and you're a little kid, especially, it's expected you would want to go and see the changing of the guard. You want to have a ride in a black cab. You want to go on a double decker bus, all of this sort of, you know, stuff. I couldn't care less. I had this kind of Dickensian view of London, that it was just this sort of ghastly, terrifying, frightening place. And I just wanted to be out in the open air. However, my mum was a canny woman. She knew a thing or two about the psychology of her son. And so she saved a visit to the Natural History Museum in London till the end of the sort of mid-afternoon. And that way she got complete sort of compliance from the reluctant child at her side.
Right. Smart.
Oh, yeah. And so we went into the Natural History Museum, and it was...
And what a museum it is.
Oh, what a museum it is. I love that place. It's so inspiring. This was back in the day when as you walked into the entrance, it wasn't Hope, the blue whale skeleton, which was hung above you, suspended above you in the hall. This was when it was the Diplodocus, which, you know, it was epic. You know, it was unbelievably exciting to walk into that place. It still is, but yeah, I'm a generation which just, you know, we grew up loving dinosaurs and all that stuff. So yeah. It was so cool. But once you got beyond that hallway, and I guess it's not fashionable these days, you know, cases of taxidermy and, you know, displays of beautifully pinned butterflies and so on. But you've got to understand, this was the early 1980s, and I was seeing stuff which I just could not believe existed. And we didn't have as well the sort of the amazing natural history documentaries which we take for granted these days on the television and the internet. You know, that stuff was really few and far between. It was a really big deal to have an Attenborough, you know, come on a Sunday night. You know, that was like a highlight for me of the year. And so we're walking through the corridors, and I was just like a kid in a candy store, you know, everything was wonderful and amazing. And it was late afternoon and the sun was shining into this really long corridor. And I remember this really vividly. It was a sort of seminal moment. It's a Damascene moment. There was a glass cabinet, and inside it were a couple of hundred stuffed taxidermied hummingbirds. And, you know, I've been back to see them since. They're in a different location in the museum these days, where the sun doesn't hit them. But back then...
Is this the huge cabinet that's full of like a tree? It's almost like a branch tree and there's...
Yes!
Yeah, I know this cabinet. I have a picture of this in my phone.
There you go, so do I. And I have to say, I've shown people this when I've been doing talks about hummingbirds in the last 6 months, and it just looks crap. It looks absolutely awful.
But up close, it's amazing. You have to admit. I mean, yes, it's a bit dated now.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, because... Back then, in that corridor, the sun came in, and those hummingbirds had obviously decades of being hit by the sun, so they were a bit faded. I mean, some of them are probably almost 200 years old, some of the oldest specimens. They're a bit dusty, they're a bit flea-bitten, you know, they're not looking their best. But I hadn't seen a real hummingbird at this point, and so what I was seeing were birds which were shaped like no other bird I had seen in the garden at home. You know, they were just these really amazing long sickle-shaped wings, tails with, you know, huge, long tails longer than the body of the bird itself, and with these sort of, you know, amazing spatules, these great big sort of discs of feather on the end, bills which, again, you know, like the sword-billed hummingbird, were longer than the body of the bird, just and really curved, hooked bills, amazing things. All of that, the forms were incredible, but what actually was really exciting was when the sun hit these birds, they blazed with colour. And these were not colors like, you know, I always say, you know, you have to understand why hummingbirds. Yet if any of your listeners are familiar with old world Palearctic warblers, well, all I'm saying is they are not like the warblers you guys have in the spring in the US. Our warblers are kind of brown. And maybe green, but we're not talking like a bright, zesty lime green. We're mainly talking a sort of dull olive. So our warblers are just really understated. Your warblers are really kind of lysergic, bright colours. So put that context there. For me to see birds which were that bright and colourful and iridescent and every colour of the rainbow there and then in that moment, yeah, I didn't know birds like that existed. And this takes us back to this sort of, you know, well, how do you find more about these things? How do you find out stuff back in the pre-internet days? I went to the library and there were one or two pictures, but that doesn't really prepare you for what hummingbirds do. The sort of defining thing about the whole humming flight, you know, the hovering, the flying backwards. And then when you sort of delve a bit deeper and you learn about the amazing adaptations, the physiological stuff, and you learn the evolutionary path they've taken to get to that point. Well, of course, all of this stuff came later. And so the seed was planted, but it took a while to sort of germinate. I knew I wanted to learn more, and I had to have a gradual accretion of knowledge through the sort of 1980s. And then, of course, you know, I went to university, the 1990s, the internet comes along, there's better natural history programs. You know, I know what hummingbirds are now. And I just had this burning desire. I've got to see hummingbirds. I really want to see these things. You know, I've read so much about them. I've seen them on the TV. I've heard David Attenborough speaking in such sort of breathless, excited tones about them. You know, I want to see them for myself. And
wait, so you hadn't seen them in the flesh?
No, not until, oh my goodness, where are we? Not until about 10 years ago. There we go.
What? Wait, are there no hummingbirds in the UK? I'm very confused right now.
Okay.
As a little boy, you never saw. They're just so common here.
You are so spoiled. And this is a really cool thing. And I'm going to build you guys in the Americas up, and I'm going to just knock you right down here. So hummingbirds are found in the Americas only, and nowhere else in the world.
Wait,
and they're found
what?
They're found from Alaska in the far north, and this is really cool. They're found at 60 degrees north, which is really far north, and that's the same latitude as Shetland. So, yeah, we are a long way north. in June, in midsummer, we, just like Alaska, we get 21 hours of daylight. And conversely, in the winter, yeah, 21 hours of darkness. It's pretty grim. And yet in the summer, there are hummingbirds at that latitude in Alaska. There are Rufus and very probably Anna's hummingbirds now breeding up there. And at the other end of the scale, right down on the shores of the Beagle Channel in Argentina, in Tierra del Fuego, there are hummingbirds there as well. So the Americas, every single possible habitat that you can find between those two points has got hummingbirds at one point or another in the year, if not all year round. Deserts, right up to just below the snow line in the Andes, rainforests, of course, cloud forests, you know, you name it, hummingbirds, mangrove swamps, they have, there'll be at least one species which has found a niche. And as you rightly say, four stories up in eastern Los Angeles, there are hummingbirds there too. But not here.
How strange, though, that they've decided. How strange that we often think of these kind of ecological bands as existing at certain latitudes or as existing at certain elevations. But how strange that there's a longitudinal band of this bird that they don't want to, like, because the habitat is so similar as you follow a latitude.
Absolutely. And there are hummingbirds in the Andes which actually make a migration, but it's an altitudinal migration up and downhill depending on the season, which I just think is wonderful. And then, of course, in the US, going back to the Alaskan ones, the Rufus hummingbirds, which are breeding up there in the summer, you know, those hummingbirds are making a proper latitudinal migration of some 3,000, 3,500 miles from Alaska to winter down in Mexico or Florida these days as well. So, I mean, it, pound for pound, and a Rufus hummingbird is a tiny little thing. You know, there are other bird species, Arctic terns, for example, which breed in the Arctic and winter in the Antarctic, which make a longer migration, but they're big birds. You know, Rufus hummingbird is a tiny little thing powered on sugar, basically, and they're making the most epic migration. So, you know, I've built you up here, but now it's time to just knock you guys down, because your hummingbirds, you've got them everywhere. They're brilliant. Yeah, they originally came from Europe.
Wait, why aren't they there anymore?
Yeah, we had ice ages. It was a crap time.
But, so it wasn't because of us.
No, oh God, no. We have plenty of sins where hummingbirds and the rest of the natural world are concerned, but this is not one of them. The fact we haven't got hummingbirds still in Europe. But I love this. This is so cool. There are hummingbird fossils which have been found in the Americas, and they're about 1 or 2 million years old, and that's plenty old. However, there was a German paleontologist, a guy called Gerald Meyer, who in 2004, he was looking at some early bird fossils which had been pulled out of a German clay pit. And he looked at them and he had that sort of eureka moment when he looked at the wing bones and of these fossils. And he thought, well, hang on, that's a hummingbird. And I know. And this is just beggars belief. He named those first hummingbirds, Eurotrochilus inexpectatus. Now, my Linnaean binomial sort of Latin or Greek isn't brilliant, but even I can translate that one. It's unexpected European hummingbird. I mean, unexpected, I think, is a massive understatement. I think he must have had to pick himself up off the floor. Now, how old were these fossils? And this is the killer. They were 30 million years old. And so we know that hummingbirds originally evolved in Europe when Europe was a much hotter, lusher, more temperate place than it is now. And I mean, there's other birds as well. You've got, what are they called? Huatzins in South America, these wonderful primitive birds, which, again, there's a fossil record which shows that they came from Europe as well. So at some point in the very, very distant past, they made it across to the Americas and then basically got isolated there when Europe turned real cold and unpleasant. They were left in the Americas and they were very happy there. And so you've still got them now. And so the hummingbird, once there, yeah.
Sorry to interject, but the hummingbird is to Europe as the camel is to North America.
It's so weird.
It's weird when people find out like camels originated here, although we don't have camels anymore. They're just so that we so identify them with like North Africa and the Middle East. We don't think of camels as being American, but
that's your export. You gave the world camels. We gave you hummingbirds.
Nice.
To see hummingbirds, I had to come to America, and well, that was no hardship. As you know, and I have to say that was why I first visited America, was really to see hummingbirds, and it went from there.
And what a thing to come here to see, because it's so, they're so common, and of course there are, you know, so many different species. So in your sort of, I don't want to say hunt, in your trek to find some quite rare and unique species. Obviously, you know, there were twists and turns along the way, but you can just take a walk in most areas of the U.S. At least, I mean, I don't know. I assume growing up in Texas, they were quite common. Living here in L.A., they're quite common. I think most parts of at least the continental U.S., you see them everywhere.
Yeah, you do, and there are more species in the south and the western states. The eastern states are a little impoverished because it's cooler there, and there isn't as much diversity. But also, the closer you get to the equator, so you know the southern states, you just have more diversity of species, and you get some of the species which are found in Central America are pushing their ranges, you know, sort of they're north, and some of them will turn up as occasional vagrants into the very southern states. One of the first hummingbirds I saw, in fact, was in Arizona. This gorgeous thing called violet capped hummingbird, and they're, by the standards of some of the birds you see in South America, they're pretty subdued. They're sort of this gorgeous sort of mink brown and white hummingbird, which looks, as I say, quite subtle, until you see on the males this sort of the eponymous violet cap, which looks like a shard of amethyst. They're just fabulous looking things. And you know, they're not a breeding species in the US, but they turn up as vagrants pretty reliably in certain places in Arizona. And so yes, one of the first hummingbirds I saw was one of these sort of slightly unusual ones. And let's be honest, I love seeing all of the kind of, you know, the regular stuff which occurs in its natural habitats, but as a birder, yeah, there's a little bit of a sort of spark which is lit when you see something a little bit rare and out of context. And so it ticked a few boxes for me. It was pretty. It was, you know, it was somewhere where it shouldn't necessarily have naturally be found. It was a hummingbird, and that was enough at that stage.
I love it. You know, it's funny. I was just looking as we were talking. There are no hummingbirds in Hawaii. I would almost think is such a hummingbird, would be such a hummingbird haven, but no, they don't. They don't naturally exist there.
No, and I find that's really interesting because Hawaii, of course, is an isolated marine location, and you could think to yourself, okay, well, that would explain why there are no hummingbirds there, but one of the hummingbirds I saw in South America, something called the Juan Fernandez firecrown, is found on only on one island these days. It was formerly on two of the islands in the Juan Fernandez archipelago. And that's about 500 miles off the coast of Chile. So it's right out there in the Pacific. And I mean, you know, that's not a huge distance, but it's pretty big. And they've been isolated there for such a long time. Most hummingbirds are sexually dimorphic. The males and the females look different to one another, but the Juan Fernandez firecrown takes that to sort of an extreme unparalleled in the hummingbird family. And for many years, until comparatively recently, I believe in the 1980s, even people still thought there were two different species of endemic hummingbird on Isla Robinson Crusoe, the main inhabited island there, because the male and the female look so different. The male is this, and I appreciate this is, we don't have, you know, visuals here on the podcast, but
yeah.
So I'm going to have to describe it in the medium of words. The male looks like a glowing hot coal. He's this wonderful, deep, rich, cinnamony color with, and it's all over, it's an all over body color, but his forehead is this beautiful, fiery iridescence of yellows and scarlets, which depending on the angle which the light catches his forehead, it blazes. So I mean, yeah, male hummingbirds, like of all species, they're complete show-offs. That's, you know, what they do. But the female, for my money, is more attractive than the male in the Juan
Fernandez. Really? Because usually they're just kind of beige.
Yeah, a beige or just kind of a really practical dull green on top, white underneath, which when you think about sitting in a nest, or you know, living in a raising chicks or young in a sort of bushy environment, that makes total sense, because a predator is less likely to see you looking up against the sky if you're white underneath, and equally looking down is less likely to see you if you've got a sort of dull green upper part. But the Juan Fernandez firecrown female dispenses with that. I mean, the basic sort of theory is the same. She's kind of, you know, greeny on top and white underneath, but nah, she has these amazing spangles of ultramarine and blue and green all over her belly, the snow white belly, this sort of blazing blue, sort of Caribbean blue forehead. She's just this gorgeous confection of bright color. And that was because, of course, they found themselves happily isolated on an island where there were really no predators to speak of. And so in time, you know, female Juan Fernandez firecrowns could dispense with the need to be really subtle and could sort of let rip with the whole evolutionary thing. Yeah, bright colors, we'll have some of those. And that was wonderful until mankind turned up, and that all went a bit wrong then, because we bought all of our usual problems. We bought rats and mice and cats and dogs and goats and sheep and horses and cows. So all the native vegetation was getting hammered. There were things eating young hummingbirds and catching them. And then for good measure, someone decided to introduce coatim mundi, these ghastly omnivorous mammals from the South American mainland. They're there and now. And just to sort of put the final nail in the Juan Fernandez firecrown's coffin, someone introduced brambles, you know, the thorny shrub which you get delicious blackberries from. Someone introduced those as a stop-proof fence, and of course they've spread all across the island and they smother and outcompete the native vegetation. So it's by any standards, it's almost like a perfect storm, and that is a hummingbird which is in genuinely real trouble now. 400 individuals left on one island in the world. That's it.
That's horrifying.
It is. And this was a really sobering moment for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously the hummingbird, I think, is a sort of a representation of clearly a larger issue. It really, I think, shows from a conservation perspective, a concept that is very hard for a lot of people to grasp. I know that from the time that I've spent in Africa, and I'm by no means an expert on you know, Southern African fauna, but one of the things that I recognize when I speak to locals in Southern Africa about the complex interplay of hunting and raising money for anti-poaching patrols and the devastating impacts of poaching, and then the work that so many brilliant people are doing to conserve these kind of native species, is that we often think of an organism as a single entity. Like, elephants are threatened, elephants are not doing well. And it's like, well, yes, that's true. And yes, they are endangered, but there are populations over here that are where their numbers are too high. And there are populations over there where the numbers are devastatingly low. And it's not as easy as I think we often want to think it is when we look at something as an entire category.
Absolutely. And this is something where, you know, the natural world is nuanced. It's easy to pick out, particularly with the hummingbirds, which often have very geographically specific ranges. I mean, you know, elephants have, African elephants, to take your example, have a broad range across a lot of Africa. There are some hummingbirds which are found in one river valley in Peru, for example, or as we were just talking about, one tiny island out there in the Pacific and nowhere else. And we barely understand some of these species' habitat requirements, let alone, you know, what we have done perhaps at a more existential level with global heating, which might be for the really high altitude species, it might be simply removing the habitat they have and making it smaller and smaller and smaller, the area of habitat left available to them. Or it might be the sort of the more insidious stuff, which is very much a localized impact. And there's a good example of this. There was a researcher in, I think, British Columbia, who was looking at the traces, or looking for traces of neonicotinoid pesticides in the feces and urine of hummingbirds, and also in bumblebees, in and these were animals which were feeding around blueberry fields, commercial blueberry crops, which were being sprayed with these pesticides.
And we're pretty aware of the outcome on bees, but I guess we haven't, you know, it's not common to have a conversation about the outcome on birds.
And this, it has much the same reaction. Basically, these neonicotinoids affect the cerebral activity of the birds, and in particular their memory. And that for a migratory species, that's a real problem, because, you know, in theory, that could affect their ability to migrate safely from where they breed to where they winter, and vice versa. But also, of course, you have to remember that hummingbirds follow feeding patterns. They work a territory, and so if your ability to navigate back to sources of nectar is impaired at a local level, that too could have an effect. And I mean, the statistics are absolutely ghastly, but go back to rufous hummingbirds, which are, you know, one of the species in question, which are found, you know, in the northern latitudes, their population simply between 1966 and 2014 has dropped by 62%. So almost two thirds of rufous hummingbirds are gone. And to go back to where we started very early on, when we're talking about sort of historical records in books, you know, stuff which isn't necessarily out there, there were early European naturalists who came to America and were walking around, and one of them recorded rufous hummingbirds. And I always thought this must be an exaggeration, but I'm wondering these days, in sort of native wildflower meadows, and he reckoned they were there at a population density of 1,000 birds per acre. And you think that's just not credible, but maybe it was. You know, if we've lost that much just since the late 1960s, which is practically when I was born, you know, I was born in the early 70s. If we've lost that many in that time, you know, what have we lost in the last 150 years or 200 years? It's really ghastly. And I, as a nature writer, I want to enthuse people and get people interested and caring about these things. But at the same time, when I was writing the book, I was learning lots of stories like this, and also, you know, we're talking about conservation efforts which are directed at one particular species, you know, and you sort of think, when you hear that, you know, for example, the marvelous spatula tail in Peru, you know, real efforts being made to conserve its habitat and return some of the former coffee plantations to native planting. And it all sounds great, but I sort of think to myself, in the bigger picture, are we just papering over the cracks here with these things, and maybe even making ourselves feel a little bit better about the bigger picture, which we know is just going to hell in a handcart? And I came away, you know, absolutely from this whole sort of immersion, this deep dive into the hummingbird's world, which was brilliant on so many levels. And, you know, please don't think I'm at all ungrateful for the wonderful things I've seen. But at the same time, I came away really sort of knocked for six. It was a chastening experience too, because it really brought home to me the bigger issues which are at play here. either at a sort of a macro or a micro level. It was pretty sobering, really.
Well, and this really comes down to, I think, a fundamental existential issue that we're all dealing with, that is larger than us dealing with it. Kind of in a more applied sense, you know, over the many years that I've worked in science communication, I've of course collected along the way many, many friends who work in conservation ecology, who are naturalists themselves, who are science writers about the natural world. And one of the biggest things that we sort of discuss offline is this struggle with how do I write about this topic and strike the right balance between being hopeful, between being excited, between capturing somebody's imagination and being sobering. And we saw this recently with David Attenborough's newest piece, where he said, "I can't do it anymore without talking about the detriment. I can't just celebrate without showing the other side." And listeners might remember, and I've referenced this before, that I had a woman on the show named Jo Ruxton, who is a producer on Blue Planet. And she spent so many years working on Blue Planet, showing this very inspiring, yet, as she described it, quite sanitized view of the ocean. She's like, it wasn't like that when you're down there filming. In all these minutes or hours of footage, you're finding the pristine seconds to air because, oh, now that scene has a plastic bag floating through it or a fishing net. And so that inspired her to then make a film, a documentary called A Plastic Ocean, which showed the dark side of this, you know, beautiful series that she worked on, Blue Planet.
Well, this really was my experience as well, because the Orchid book I wrote was perhaps quite an old-fashioned piece of nature writing, because it was very celebrational. It was just a joy. I set out to see all of the orchids, which occur naturally in Britain and Ireland in the course of one summer. So there was a sort of, you know, a framework to hang basically a wonderful celebration of the plants, the places they're found, people involved, past and present, with the plants and the places. It was just joyous, and you know, I love doing it, but there was a sort of lingering that I touched on a couple of sort of, you know, aspects where, you know, there were plants under threat, and I did have a sort of lingering feeling afterwards that, you know, that's not telling the entire story here. And as I say, the more I sort of saw with the hummingbirds, I just felt that I had to tell it as I saw it, and perhaps to the detriment of some reviewers, because if you're explaining the context of why some of these birds are in trouble, you have to touch on politics and man's activity and economic development and just what, you know, cost that comes at, and the sort of this endless fiction that governments peddle, that we can have constant economic growth. Well, we can't. It's a finite place, this planet, with finite resources and a growing population. Something has to give. And so, you know, I dived in and touched into some of that stuff in The Glitter in the Green, and it was really interesting. I mean, any writer will know what I'm saying here. You look at reviews through your fingers and perhaps don't look at some at all, because they're just so ghastly. And so, some of the things that people had to say were, well, you know, how dare you mention politics, and how dare you criticize decisions made by various political parties or leaders, or, you know, that's not your place as a naturalist and a writer. I thought I was getting a celebration about hummingbirds. Well, I hope the celebration is still there, but at the same time, I couldn't not tell it as I saw it, because you've got to. How could you explain some of the issues without explaining, you know, the causes?
Yeah. And I think that we obviously we're tapping into something here that, you know, I close my show every week and we're getting there, but not quite yet, with the same two questions, which are these big picture questions about where we find hope and where we find and where we struggle. You know, you and I will discuss your answers to those two questions, but I can imagine that we're dipping our toe a bit in this idea of the sort of the ambivalence, the juxtaposition, the diametric yet existing at the same time concept of hope and of beauty and of just awe that the natural world gives us, and the absolute bittersweet sadness that comes from knowing that we ourselves are changing it at a pace that we cannot, at a runaway pace, a pace that we cannot undo the damage. We can try to mitigate it, but it requires an act of will that clearly we have not shown we're capable of exercising. And you know, as you're out and about and you're traveling and you're seeing all of this beauty, I can imagine that every time, you know, you're moved to tears by an image in the flesh, that there's almost an arresting moment that says, like, oh, what are we doing?
Yeah, this was it. The whole thing became quite inflected with that poignancy. It was as a narrative arc, really, from the initial, God, my first hummingbird, isn't it wonderful? And then, you know, so seeing lots of different, you know, hummingbirds, some really remarkable ones, and that sort of upward trajectory, and then as I worked my way down through the Americas, and you started to sort of to and also researching, dive a little deeper. Yeah, it did become a very bittersweet experience. And to return to the Juan Fernandez firecrown, that was kind of the penultimate species I saw. And there was a sort of a real moment there. You know, this was one of the, it was a really romantic hummingbird to see that out there on Isla Robinson Crusoe, you know, the island which Defoe got his inspiration for the eponymous novel, Robinson Crusoe, from the shipwrecked Scottish sailor Alexander Selkirk. All that stuff really appealed to me. It's a wonderful story. And I went there, and I knew the hummingbirds were in some trouble. I'd looked at the bird life statistics, and they said there's, you know, 1,000 birds left. And I found myself, and you know, late one evening, sat at a bar chatting to the guys who were on the island. They work for an absolutely brilliant NGO called Oikonos, who I, if anyone has got a couple of spare dollars or pounds and would like to donate to them, I heartily recommend you do, because they do brilliant stuff all through the Americas. But I was chatting to these guys, and I sort of, you know, like a good writer, I said, so, you know, how, you know, you're obviously doing all this work here to try and grow native species which are endemic to the island, to eradicate the brambles, to plant these species, to, you know, try and educate the islanders about the need to control cat numbers and so on and so on. So this is all brilliant stuff. How are the hummingbirds doing? How is that population of 1,000 hummingbirds doing? And the sort of main guy, he looked and he just laughed, and he said, John, you've been reading the bird life statistics. There's not 1,000 Juan Fernandez firecrowns here. There's 400. And we know that because we go out and we find every single nest every year. And in the context of what I was seeing on the island, I sort of realized that this, you know, the conservation work they were doing, they couldn't possibly, without an enormous application of capital, of investment, they couldn't eradicate the rodents on the island. He just sort of shook his head, and he said, you know, 20, 30 years, it'll probably be extinct. And that was that moment where I thought, you know, I've been hearing sort of quite stories of sort of redemption and hope with other hummingbirds. And I suppose I'd allowed myself to dare to hope and to think, you know, actually maybe we are stepping back from the brink and, you know, we can save these very niche species. But then I sort of thought to myself, well, actually, you know, maybe we can't actually with all of them. And looking a bird in the eye, you know, and knowing that it was probably going to be extinct within my lifetime, that was awful. You know, when nobody knew that the dodo was going to be extinct, but then suddenly it was. But, you know, it's just the worst thing, actually. It was awful. And that, and you talked about tears, you know, I genuinely felt at the time, and now I still feel myself choking a little, because it's just awful. It's just awful.
And you're right, there's almost something even more dark and more kind of disgusting about the fact that we know we're doing it and yet we can't help ourselves, as opposed to sort of the historical naturalists who were, you know, they would go out to a place that they had never been before. They would, I mean, there's that colonial view, which was like, I am white and I own the world and I will go to a place where there are indigenous people and I will look at them as though they are savages and I will just basically steal a bunch of flora and fauna and wipe out whatever's there for my collection. And it was absolutely disgusting, but I guess the one kind of thing about it that I don't know, tempers it, although it doesn't really, is that they were sort of like so fucking privileged that they had no idea how disgusting they were.
But maybe we're no different now, though, collectively. Yeah. I mean,
some of us are aware, but many people aren't.
Exactly. And, you know, I include amongst those people, you know, really close friends who are intelligent, educated people, but, you know, they don't habitually watch natural history documentaries, for example, or read nature writing or science writing. How are they to know the stuff which you know haunts us? And when I was telling them about some of the stuff, you know, they were, you know, saying, oh, what have you seen? You know, tell us about your adventures. When I was telling them some of this dark stuff, you know, you could see the shock, and they were like, well, that's not what I expected you to tell me about. And so I don't. You know, there's no blame to be attributed to the individual here, I think, at all. And we've been, all of us, brought up in a society which has venerated economic development and growth, and which has, to fuel that, been all about freeing up disposable income for us to buy stuff. And, you know, the consumption of stuff, whether it's a new phone or a new TV or, you know, any disposable item, which we can now afford to buy in a way that our parents or our grandparents couldn't afford to do. You know, the purchase of that thing is the sort of the grease that oils the wheels of this fictional endless cycle of economic growth. And it's really difficult when you've been brought up to expect to have things to suddenly think to yourself, well, actually, I ought to be making a choice that I shouldn't have that thing because it comes at a direct cost somewhere else in the world, you know, at 100 removes from me. And I mean, to return actually to the historical thing as well, I mean, we just to give a little bit of historical context here, we've been doing this with hummingbirds for hundreds of years. In the 1800s, it was all about high fashion. Hummingbirds were consumed by us in their millions to decorate hats. And this was something which shocked me when I was looking at the sales records of auctions in London, but also in Paris and New York. These were all centers of this trade, and tens of thousands of hummingbirds would be sold in one lot alone to be turned into ornaments on hats for high fashion.
It's not that different than the ivory trade. It's not
exactly.
That. It's so easy for us to look at the ivory trade and go, ugh, how dare they? Because it's so removed from us. But it's not any different.
No, it's really no different. And actually, our sort of the nature of our footprint on the environment it's not gone away. We've stopped killing hummingbirds for hats. But, you know, we consume in different ways we impact upon them in different ways when we, I don't know, eat a chocolate bar that's got palm oil in it. You know, it's hard to think that has had an impact on wildlife, but it has, because the palm oil plantations which have been planted to grow that filthy stuff, you know, that's come at the cost of natural habitat somewhere.
And basically all the food we eat, you know, most all the food we eat comes from some combination of like large-scale agriculture or factory farming. You know, I mean, very few people in this world have the luxury of eating locally grown, you know, small farmed produce. Like most people are eating from clear-cut forests. They're eating from places where massive amounts of habitats were lost to agribusiness.
And actually, this comes back to something else we spoke about a while back when you were saying about sort of the conservation picture being more faceted and complex than we necessarily know. And the same goes with the food we eat. It is a more nuanced picture. And there's an example which I give, which may not have resonance for guys in the US, but in the UK, it's a really sort of sobering case study. We have a lot of upland hill farming in parts of Wales and Scotland and northern England. And the main thing which is reared there is lamb. And, you know, it seems quite sort of intuitive that buying local lamb must be better than buying lamb which has been imported from the other side of the world. The other big lamb producer is New Zealand. You know, that stuff's come halfway around the world. It must have a big carbon footprint, right? And there was a proper peer-reviewed study done in looking into this by, and it was commissioned by a local a government-funded economic development agency in Scotland. And they had it peer-reviewed, and they compared the carbon footprint, the whole life cycle carbon footprint of lamb reared in Scotland, in Wales, and New Zealand. And they were very much expecting this to sort of, you know, be a good marketing tool, the outcome of this, to sort of say, you know, Scotland, you should buy local, you should buy Scottish lamb. It's you know, it's the green choice to make. And they actually discovered that New Zealand lamb had a carbon footprint approximately a third that of Scottish lamb, even though it was shipped halfway around the world. And so, you know, we're conditioned to think that buying local is the right thing to do. And often it will be, but not always. And this is the thing, really, because as consumers, we, you know, a lot of us want to make the right choice. We want to do the better thing. But actually, it's really hard as consumers to know what the better thing is to do without digging really deep into every single thing we buy. And when, you know, some of these foods are processed foods, how do you even begin to understand the impact of what that burger is when you look at it as a whole thing?
And sometimes we don't have a quote better choice. The system is built so that we have to engage in the system and the system itself, you know. And I think that's been we talk about this sometimes on the other show I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, that one of the biggest kind of foists, you know, the biggest sort of fleeces that have been pulled over us by corporate, I say corporate America, but really by multinational corporations, is to put the onus back on the consumer for things like recycling, for things like making better, you know, consumer decisions. Like, the reason we buy plastic is because we don't have another option.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, this is something which, a realization which has really come to me in the last few years. It's not just corporate, not America or Britain, or, you know, it's not the corporate world which is doing this. It is also governments, and this is my conclusion about all of this. If there is meaningful change to be affected, and this is so relevant on the eve of COP26, of course, if there's meaningful change to be affected, it can't come from the individual. You know, we can care individually, and that's important. We should. But it needs to be instituted upon us at a state level. It needs to be governments which say, right, you know, this is a big existential problem, and we all are going to have to you know, square up to it. And we are all going to have to, across the board, make compromises. And we need it kind of forced upon us. And that's you know, that's miserable for all of us. But the alternative is something in the long term for our children, for us indeed in our lifetimes, but for our children, our grandchildren, it's something far more profound. And we need to address this stuff now. We won't do it individually. Some of us will, because we have the luxury of privilege and circumstance. And, you know, we can make those decisions to buy organic, buy local, you know, and pay more to do that. But for some people, that's just simply not an option, a realistic option. And so,
even the whole organic thing sometimes is.
Oh God! Don't even get me started about the derogations which allow something to be described as organic when it's still got copper sulfate dressings, and they are just
exactly. Just drives me completely. I'm over here like. Yay, biotech. Yay, let's solve this, you know. And so I think that, you know, really what this ultimately brings us to, I do think, John, are these final two questions. I close every episode by asking my guests the same two questions. The first one is the sort of rough one, and that is, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, you know, it could be personal, it could be global, it could be cosmic. What is the thing that does keep you up the most at night? The thing that you're most concerned about, maybe even pessimistic or cynical about? And then on the flip side of that, so we do end on a more positive note. I always ask about where you find hope and where you find your optimism. And I'm just wondering, you know, when, because a lot of times, you know, I'll hear people say climate change, and I'll hear people say pollution, and I'll hear people say these answers to the question. And when I think about it, I come down to like a place of kind of tribalism, a place of power structure and dynamics, a more psychological framework around the decision-making that we have and how that ultimately downstream affects all of things. It sounds to me like your sort of, I don't want to say reductionistic, but your way that you've been trying to get to the pure essence of this problem rests on economic systems. Like, it comes down to this sort of laissez-faire capitalism of uncontrolled growth can't happen in a closed system. It is a zero-sum game.
Well, I mean, yeah, full disclosure here. I didn't become a lawyer like my mum and dad wanted me to. Nor did I become the proper formally trained scientist that I wanted to become. A middle ground was reached where I failed my exams. I think I'll admit this now publicly. I failed my exams at school deliberately so I wouldn't become a lawyer.
Self-sabotage.
I did. Yeah, I did.
Brilliant.
I know. But by the same token, I had to do something, and I ended up in one last nod of obedience to my parents to get a proper job, in inverted commas. I trained as an economist. And so I have an economic development background professionally. Until the last few years, that's what I did. And so I guess I'm kind of poacher turned gamekeeper, or vice versa here, because, you know, I have seen the system from within. I have worked. My background actually was agricultural economics, but I ended up.
Yeah, I mean, but how better to understand the motivations and the structure within than to be there? I mean, obviously, this wasn't your Aaron Brockovich moment. You weren't, not even the best reference, but you weren't going in to expose. But,
oh, God, no.
You've learned things that are probably very remote from most of our understandings.
Yeah, I guess. I suppose, really, and, you know, it comes down to, you know, how do I see a glimmer of, not hope, that's the wrong word, but how do I see, and solution is far too big a word too, but how do I see some sort of way to at least minimize, perhaps mitigate, perhaps address this sort of vast super tanker of problems, and maybe start to turn its course very slowly around? I have to say, I see it in economics and politics, and I have a great deal of contempt for politics as a whole, because demonstrably it hasn't delivered necessarily public goods. It's delivered economic benefits. And it only takes the pandemic to see the sort of the cronyism which has taken place, where contracts have been awarded to companies which are sort of, you know, hand in hand with politicians to deliver vaccines or testing regimes and so on. And it sort of beggars belief in a time when, you know, the world has been reeling from something as profound as a global pandemic, that shit still goes on, but it does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the outcomes of the pandemic are that most people got poorer and the rich got richer. Like, this is objective data. We saw
absolutely
this happening.
Yeah. So, you know, we are a leopard which doesn't necessarily change its spots. Having said that, I do think that even the sort of the super rich and privileged people who are part of those corporations are perhaps beginning to wake up to the fact that you can be as rich as you like or as powerful as you like as a corporation, but if the world is burning or is flooding, that money is worth, you know, it's worth fuck all. It's a it is not going to see your, you know, it's not going to see you right. And I do think that as well, you know, that we spoke about sort of, you know, a lot of people not being aware of perhaps, you know, biodiversity loss. And perhaps the same goes for the sort of the greater woes of the world. But people are waking up to it. People are becoming aware of this stuff, and pressure is starting to mount on governments to deliver an alternative future, a future which, you know, isn't predicated on endless economic growth, and actually is perhaps all about naked self-interest of, you know, can you please stop the world heating up and sea level rise happening and these terrible wildfires and these awful floods? You know, perhaps, you know, you do something about it, government, because you're the one who looks after us, right? And I my glimmer of hope, my candle of hope in the darkness is that perhaps for the wrong reasons, but the right outcome will come, where governments will affect the big changes upon us, which individually some of us will make, but some of us won't, for very real and tangible and understandable human reasons. But, you know, the changes will be instituted that will start to turn the ship and change its course. You know, I come back to the sort of my innate cynicism about human nature. We look at what we just spoke about, the, you know, what's happened during the pandemic, and we've still, you know, seen some terrible acts of cronyism and corruption and just self-interest and greed. But surely to God, there's going to come a point when, hopefully not too late, we will change.
Yeah. Yeah, here's hoping. Well, everyone, the book is The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds by John Donne. John, thank you so much for joining me, for teaching us all about how cool hummingbirds are, all about their plight, and a little bit more about natural history and kind of the state of the globe along the way.
Oh, thank you, Cara. I feel I've not spoken enough about hummingbirds. I've just
that's what the book is about. People, yeah, read the book.
Yeah, read the book, guys. Please do. But yeah. No, and honestly, I have to say, the book is not as miserable as I maybe sound this evening here in Shetland. Just like, oh, everything's going to hell in a handcart.
It's so windy outside. God damn it!
It's pitch dark and it's raining, and I can't see the aurora borealis. You know, there are really lovely human stories in the book. There's wonderful natural history stories, and you know, there is hope and there's redemption and there's some really cool stuff happening out there, and at the end of the day, the birds are so wonderful. And so yeah, it is a nice book. Please go and pick up a copy and read it.
Absolutely. Thank you once again so much for sharing with us. I had an absolute blast.
Oh, me too. Thank you. It's been a joy.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk to you.